Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+ terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18+. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
You are listening to Preconceived, where we examine the preconceptions that shape how we view the world and the paradigms by which we live our lives.
Hey everybody, I'm Zale Mednick, and welcome to another episode of Preconceived. If you're enjoying this podcast, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or whatever podcasting platform you use. I know I say that occasionally. It really helps spread the podcast so other people can listen to it and so that we can continue producing this for it. So I would really appreciate that if you have been enjoying the podcast and have been a loyal listener. The rates of plastic surgery have risen exponentially over the past couple of decades. With the advent of Botox and fillers, cosmetic procedures have become much quicker to administer and more accessible to the mass public. In many ways, one could argue this is a good thing. It offers a service to people who want it in a more available way than ever. But in other ways, has the obsession with a certain definition of beauty and staying younger only further stigmatized getting older and aging naturally? And has the world of cosmetic surgery perhaps gone too far and fostered a certain type of addiction, so to speak, to looking younger? And what are some of the newer trends we are seeing in plastic surgery? And what might surprise us regarding cosmetic procedures that doesn't quite fit with the story we hear from the media? I'm joined today by Dr. Harmeet Gill. Dr. Gill is a Royal College and Board certified oculofacial plastic surgeon that specializes in cosmetic and reconstructive surgical and non-surgical procedures of the eyelids, brows, and face. He is an assistant professor at the University of Toronto and consultant surgeon at Sunnybrook Health Science Center. He completed his oculofacial plastic reconstructive and orbital surgery fellowship at the University of California, San Francisco Hospitals and Clinics and Stanford University. All right, Dr. Harmeet Gill, welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thanks so much, Zale. Great to connect.
It's great to connect, and you're a colleague, which is rare to have on Preconceived. I've only had a couple other ophthalmologists on the show, I think one or two. So very excited to have another ophthalmologist on the show, and we're going to be talking more so in the vein of cosmetic plastic surgery, not just around the eyes, but just around the face in general. But delighted to have a colleague on the show.
Yeah, same.
So there's a lot of different avenues that I want to explore here. And I think it's helpful to start off by just understanding a little bit better Botox and fillers, some of the science of it, and just some of how it works practically. So why don't we start about Botox a little bit and how exactly it works?
Yeah, absolutely, Zale. So, you know, just to start off, like in terms of facial injectables and you know, botulinum toxin, popular brand for with Allergan is called Botox. Also, Xeomin with Mertz and Dysport with Galderm. All of those are essentially the same active ingredient, which is botulinum toxin A. Sometimes I'll just start off by saying it is kind of lumped in with fillers. We often say, oh, Botox and fillers. But as we'll chat about throughout the podcast, they're actually quite different in terms of the way they work, the risks versus benefits, and sort of what the anticipated results are and how they affect the tissues in the short term and long term over the years. So we'll dive deep into that. But to start off with botulinum toxin or Botox, it was really developed for functional uses. And as I'm sure you know, it was born sort of in the ophthalmology world because Botox was developed by a guy named Dr. Alan Scott, who is an ophthalmologist in California. And he developed it to really treat eye movement disorders, so strabismus, as well as spasmodic conditions around the eyes, including blepharospasm. And so, you know, one of the doctors in British Columbia, Dr. Gene Crothers, started noticing that, hey, wait a minute, when I'm starting to use this active ingredient for these functional issues, it's actually causing a lot of unanticipated but happy patients with aesthetic benefits because it's also decreasing the wrinkles that are associated with those decreased muscle contractions. And so over the years, you know, Allergan eventually acquired the rights, and now it, you know, it's like a $1 billion industry worldwide. And, you know, this botulinum toxin injections are used on a regular basis. So, you know, in terms of what Botox is used for, there are still a lot of functional disorders where it is approved. These will include the blepharospasm we talked about, which is like an involuntary contraction of the eyelids. And some patients where after they've had, let's say, a stroke or even for other reasons, after a Bell's palsy, can have a partial facial contraction called a hemifacial spasm, where again, those involuntary muscle contractions can be treated with Botox. And other than, you know, stopping the involuntary muscle contractions, Botox is also helpful for decreasing sweat gland activity. So people who have, let's say, really sweaty hands, armpits, forehead, condition you can call hyperhidrosis, Botox is used for that, has indications for that, as well as migraine headaches, excessive tearing, and also a lot of different types of pain disorders other than migraines or tension headaches. It helps with that as well. So the way that Botox works is it basically stops a neurotransmitter called acetylcholine. And acetylcholine is released at the connection between a nerve and a muscle, so a neuromuscular junction. And it's also released when a nerve is communicating with sweat glands. So basically, the Botox inhibits the release. Now, some of my patients will be confused because they're like, well, if the word has tox in it, it must be toxic or cytotoxic. But the truth is that, you know, Botox really isn't toxic. And a lot of the injectors now will refer to it as a neuromodulator, which means it modulates the relationship or the communication between a nerve and either the sweat gland or the muscle. And it's a temporary modulation, so it's not permanent. So typically Botox, once it's injected at its intended site, will start to impact the end tissue, the muscle per se, in 1 to 3 days where you start noticing somewhat of an effect. And it usually reaches its peak effect between 10 to 14 days. So that means that's when the muscle is at its weakest or where the Botox is most effective. So let's say you want to get Botox sale before, you know, a good friend's wedding. You may want to time it about 2 weeks before that big event to get its ideal benefit. And then essentially after those 2 weeks, it starts to decrease in efficacy. And then it usually wears off on average for most people at about 3 months. Sometimes it wears off a little bit sooner, depending on the person's physiology and metabolism. And sometimes it can last even longer. You know, I've had patients where they say the benefit of it lasts for 6 months. To be honest, I don't think that the chemical itself is blocking acetylcholine for that period of time, but our muscles also adapt, and so there's a lot of factors at play in terms of understanding sort of how Botox will affect a specific patient. So I find that each person is, you have to kind of tweak, and I always warn our patients that we're going to start conservative, and you usually modify the injection patterns every 3 to 4 months as you're doing their injections over time.
So that's a different paradigm than I had thought about it, of because the way you said it, if you had an important event, for example, and you wanted to reduce your wrinkles, you could kind of come in and say, I want some Botox and I want to have its optimal effect in 2 weeks. And then there's other people who are getting Botox saying, I want to get it on a regular basis because I want to prevent kind of that aging look and wrinkles in general. For somebody who's coming in for the latter, who's saying, I kind of want to go on a regular regimen of Botox, and we can talk about fillers afterwards because they are different conversations. How frequently are people typically getting Botox in that situation?
For sure, Zale. So with Botox, really, it's a good question. So, let's kind of use different patient examples. So if you have a 20-something year old patient who comes in and just wants some quote unquote preventative Botox, or they find that they're using like frowning all the time in photos and stuff, and they just want a preventative Botox, really for both short-term and long-term benefits, if that's the intended goal, you do want to use it every 3 months. Like that's where you'll get the best kind of long-term benefit from it. And there are studies that have been done in twins where, genetically they're similar, and they've tried to, have similar patients match for lifestyle factors. And in the long term, in the 40 or so years that Botox has been around and been studied, they did find that if you're doing maintenance Botox, you are going to have less wrinkles and your face will look less aged, and there will be a lot of aesthetic benefits. And so that, if let's say money and sort of getting your mind around having to come in and do the injections were not barriers, and your main goal was to look youthful, then, doing regular consistent Botox would be the best option. So, talking a little bit about the safety of Botox, or what the long-term effects are. Interestingly, I was involved in a research study with one of the docs here in Toronto, Dr. Stephen Kraft, who does a lot of Botox for cosmetic and functional purposes. He's a famous strabismus surgeon, but he's also one of the direct fellows of Dr. Alan Scott as well, who created Botox. So he did his fellowship with him in San Francisco. But essentially, when I was a resident, Dr. Kraft and I wanted to look at, what is the long-term efficacy of botulinum toxin? And we looked at the patient population of like functional patients who had blepharospasm and hemifacial spasm. And one of the reasons we could do this study on long-term efficacy is because Dr. Kraft is one of the first people in Canada who was injecting patients. So we just had a lot of patient files that we could review. And, so the big theories that were combating one another were one that, okay, if you're injecting these patients who need it every 3 months, more or less, for their functional issues, over time, the muscle should be, getting a little bit more attenuated. It's like a use it or lose it phenomenon. Picture if, like, your right bicep was always getting Botox. You would think that over time, that muscle will be smaller in mass, and over time, you may need less and less Botox. So that makes sense. The other theory was that, no, wait a minute, this is a drug that's based on, the Clostridium botulinum bacterium that's also potentially introducing an immunogenic response in the body, and perhaps either through some kind of autoimmunologic response in making it less active, or a desensitization where, you with a lot of drugs, like let's say even a cup of coffee, you keep drinking it every day, you drink two, you drink three, you become a little bit more desensitized to its effect. So those theories were suggesting that, wait a minute, you may need actually more and more Botox over time to get the same treatment effect. So with our study, what we found is actually you need about the same amount of Botox. And we looked at patients, I'd have to look back at the exact data, but after 30 years, 35 years, on average, what you start off with more or less is what you're going to continue needing to decrease the amount of muscle contraction that you have. And the amount of Botox that every patient uses really depends on factors. Like I'm sure you know some people who express a lot with their forehead when they're speaking, and so their forehead muscles are very strong. Some people, let's say, smile a lot, or and other people are very sort of, they don't make many facial expressions at all. Part of it is your personality and your habits. And so the amount of Botox that you use can vary anywhere from, 15 to 20 units to over 100 units for people with significant facial dystonias.
And I want to go back a little bit to the mechanism in terms of, because it relates to the risks, it's affecting the ability of the muscles to move.
Exactly. So what Botox will do is it inhibits the release of acetylcholine. And so it interferes with the nerve impulses themselves. So it causes like a flaccid paralysis of the muscle. And yeah, so in terms of its muscle function impact, that's how it works, is at the neuromuscular junction, it stops the release of the acetylcholine.
And because of that, then obviously, if your muscles aren't able to move to the same extent, then wrinkles aren't able to be expressed as much.
Exactly. And so usually we form wrinkles perpendicular to the axis at which they contract. And so usually, you know, if you're thinking about, let's say, the 11 o'clock lines between your eyebrows, those are formed because of the muscles actually lie perpendicular to them. And those are the ones that are contracting the kind of frowning muscles, so to speak.
Let's say somebody's getting Botox. They start getting it in their 20s or their 30s or their 40s. And we'll jump into that conversation later from kind of a philosophical standpoint. But somebody starts getting it and they say, I want to get it for a while. And then after 10 years, they say, you know what? I think I've had enough for whatever reason and I want to stop. Does the face ever, or the muscles ever fully go back to the way they were? Or let's say somebody says, you know what, I don't love the way my face looks right now for whatever reason because of the Botox. If I stop getting it, will my face kind of go back to how it would have been otherwise if I hadn't had those 10 years of Botox? Or is it not quite like that? Are there some long-lasting changes that will occur from chronic use of it?
Yeah. So overall, Zale, I would think of it in terms of, let's say, other things. And I'm gonna assume that the Botox is done well and it's giving a good result in terms of, let's say, weakening the muscles that are providing an aesthetic benefit. We'll just assume that the patient is getting really good Botox done. It's helping take away the laugh lines and the 11 o'clocks. And from the ages of 25 to 45, let's say, they've been doing it consistently and it's been working well. But now they decided, you know what, something's changed. They can't get it anymore for some reason. So now they're going to start slowly using those muscles more and more, and they'll start using, you know, start seeing, let's say, wrinkles 5, 10, 15 years later, more or less, right? Based on, so compared to if they had never had any Botox to them have only having it for, let's say, a 20-year span, they're still kind of ahead of the curve, so to speak, you know, like they're still better off than someone who never had Botox at all. It's almost like, you know, if you exercise all the time and then you stop exercising, or you've always worn sunscreen and you stop wearing sunscreen. So then, you know, you've got a lot of accumulated benefit, but then you start to lose it, right?
Some people say they can tell when somebody's had a lot of Botox or that the face kind of looks a little bit different years later if somebody's accumulated 20, 30 years of Botox. When you're counseling somebody, you're just speaking with somebody, and you're kind of, somebody's saying, I want to initiate this pathway of Botox for however long. Is the goal to maintain a youthful look, do you say? Or is it more so just preventing the look of aging? And that's a weird question, but I guess, is there kind of a natural youthful look, a natural older look, and then a look that is a Botox type look, which means you aren't going to have those wrinkles, but obviously you're not going to look the way you were when you're 20 because Botox can't do everything and you are losing some of your ability of those muscles in the face. So it's a little bit of a different look than just telling somebody, oh yeah, we'll be able to maintain completely your youthful look and you'll look like you're 20 when you're 50.
Yeah, absolutely. Great question, Zale. And there's so many different ways we can approach this. So let me try to think of an organized response because there's so many nuances to what you just brought up. But I'm going to speak about the Botox from a practical point of view, just as a consumer product and the financials around it. And then we'll talk about patient selection separately. So the first thing is that Botox is probably one of the safest cosmetic treatments that can be done, right? So family physicians can do it. Nurses are doing it. Like there are certain laws and regulations based on, you know, your province, country, et cetera, that you have to follow, but it can be a delegated act. And so it's something that is relatively easy to learn how to inject. You know, once you've learned how to mix it, how to inject it, most practitioners can learn after a weekend course with a little bit of guidance and apprenticeship how to do it, like very quickly, which is not the case for fillers and definitely not for surgery, definitely not for most lasers, et cetera. So in the cosmetic world, Botox is basically something that a lot of non-experts can use, right? So that's one of the reasons why it's popular and it's widely available. And the companies, you know, certainly love to make it widely available. It's in the US, at least, I know it's advertised regularly on television, et cetera. The second thing is that there's relatively high profit margin with this, you know, so, you know, consumables are pretty cheap. It's not like you need to buy $500,000 laser or store very expensive filler products and so on. So out of other cosmetic interventions, it's economically easier for injectors to have access to it. So that coupled with, now to answer your question, you know, which patients are getting in at what stage of life and what perceived benefit. Now, what I'm seeing is sometimes patients will be going into like a family doctor's office, and no offense to my colleagues who are practicing family medicine and aesthetics, but they're like, oh, I was just going to go renew my blood pressure medication, but now I see these posters for Botox, and it could be like an 80-year-old. And if they ask about it, they may get it. But, you know, an 80-year-old person with, let's say, a lot of other age-related changes, such as a loose skin envelope, you know, significant volume loss in their face, and, you know, there's a whole bunch of issues with an aging face, such as, you know, bony changes, soft tissue changes. And one of the issues is that if you're just paralyzing the muscle, you may get no effect whatsoever. Or if you're injecting, let's say, just underneath the skin, which most novice injectors like to do, it could be migrating to an area where you don't want it to. And then thirdly, sometimes you're weakening muscles, which accentuates other aging problems, and then accessory muscles have to kick in. I know that sounds a little tricky, but I'll give you a specific example.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
So let's say a patient comes in, and we'll give you an example, like a 70-year-old lady who, you know, is raising her eyebrows quite a bit, has lots of forehead lines, and says, Dr. Mednik, can you please do a little Botox on my forehead? And you think, oh yeah, I can see all those lines. I'll inject 10 units. But then, you know, 2 weeks later, when it's reached full effect, you see that it's induced like significant forehead ptosis, hooding over the eyes. And then, you know, especially if one muscle, like the two halves of the face, they say are sisters, but not twins. So, you know, let's say the left muscle is a bit stronger than the right. Then all of a sudden she looks like she's had a little stroke and she looks totally bizarre. So I'm giving kind of a lot of different nuances, but what I'm trying to hint at is that the injection part is sort of easy to learn, but it's the execution of it and understanding which patient needs to be injected, how much they need, and starting very, very conservatively and kind of building upon skills. That usually requires about 3 to 5 years of training, I'd say.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Is there a trade-off that people need to be aware of that when you're getting Botox? Because people often joke about people can't move their faces if they've had so much Botox because the muscles aren't moving. Is there a trade-off, even if it's mild to some extent, that people should be aware of? Yeah, we can kind of reduce or get rid of your wrinkles, but yes, your facial movements to an extent are going to decrease even if it's subtle. Is that something that people need to be aware of, or is that a reflection of poor technique? How do you look at that?
Yeah, Zale, you know, I think with Botox, fillers, or any aesthetic intervention, it's always a matter of understanding patients' needs and then proper patient selection, and then really being clear about what you can deliver for that patient. So, you know, I think that there are some patients who get overtreated for sure. And sometimes if they get overtreated and then you see accessory muscles kicking in, they look very bizarre. And the term I'll use is all of a sudden now you're drawing attention to treated areas. So one of the cardinal rule in aesthetics, and I tell our fellows, and I think most people who practice in aesthetics would say, you never want to draw attention to treated areas, because now you are, it defies the purpose of why the person had it done. So I think that one of the good things is with Botox that after 3 months, it will wear off. And so you can refine your injection patterns. And, you know, it's a little bit interesting, but I'll tell you, like, having trained in California for my fellowship, it's interesting there. Like, I noticed even some patients wanted that look of like, hey, I just got Botox. It was social status and so forth, which didn't kind of fit with my own personal aesthetic. But I think, Zale, honestly, what you'll see is that patients will gravitate towards injectors who share their philosophies. So I'm sure you'll see some patients who love their look of like, look at me, I got Botox and I can afford it. And this is my, you know, like I'm kind of showing my social status. And they may go to injectors, and even if you see the person injecting them, they also look like they've had like drawing attention to treated areas. So it's not quite my personal preference. I like to undertreat where there's some natural movement to the face. It's very achievable. So you can get Botox where you can barely tell. It should actually be just, you know, where it's giving you a tangible benefit. So I'm obsessed with taking, you know, before and after photos and making sure that it's kind of creating some good benefits. But certainly if someone asks me to kind of, hey, I want another 10 units or really freeze my face, I avoid those. It's just not my preferred aesthetic. Not that I'm judging that it's good or bad, but it's sort of, you'll find that there's a lot of variability.
That's fascinating. I mean, in many elements of medicine, you kind of go somewhere and it's kind of, obviously there's a conversation between the doctor and the patient, but it's kind of obvious in terms of what the goal is. But here, it's interesting to hear about different practitioners having different philosophies, which makes total sense. And yeah, you do see people who have that kind of plastic look to them, and to hear that, well, maybe that was actually done intentionally because that patient wanted that look. So that is really interesting to hear you say that. In terms of, let's pivot a little bit to fillers. What's the purpose of fillers and how do those work?
Yeah, so with fillers, it really, when the fillers kind of came about, I'll be honest that it really revolutionized the entire world of facial cosmetics and cosmetic surgery. So if you think of the pre-filler phase, most facial cosmetic procedures were very subtractive in nature. So if you think about the aging face, as we all get older, there's different changes. We change in terms of our volume of our bone mass and the tendons that are attached to those bones, connecting muscles and other soft tissues. And we lose volume in different compartments of our face. So one general rule of thumb is if you look at photos of yourself from, let's say, your 20s and then your 40s and then your 60s, you'll kind of see a progression where your face started out more as an upside down triangle, or like a base up triangle, where volume was more concentrated near the top of your head and kind of tapered down to your chin. But as we get older, our face kind of becomes like a regular triangle, like a pyramid, where, you know, it's kind of a little more narrow at the top because we lose volume in our temples. And then we start to, you know, cheeks and neck starts to get thicker, and it kind of becomes a base down triangle. Now, plastic surgery for the face was really focused on pulling, tightening, and like, you know, fat was like, there's contour issues subtracting the fat. If you look at a person who comes in for, let's say, a consultation and they're worried about how they look and their facial aesthetics, what you'll find is that it's usually light and shadows. So if you think of it like an artist kind of depicting it, there's light projections and shadow projections that are drawing attention. So let's say I'm an eyelid guy. So fat pads bulging in the lower lids or lower lid bags, you'd be seeing like a hill and a valley contour, you know, and then for the lower face, like jowls around the mouth or like a neck. So we can kind of talk about how that presents in many different ways. But at the end of the day, what surgeons were doing was, you know, taking away the hills and tightening up the tissues to decrease contour and flatten out topography. However, that had some consequences because when you have a skeletonized look that looks very hollow, there's so many celebrity examples and the list goes on and on where you're like, whoa, what did they do? What did they do? Like, you know, it doesn't look like them anymore. It's horrible. But, you know, that was the subtractive way that a lot of facial surgery was done. It became clear that, you know, and a lot of surgeons and other dermatologists, other practitioners kind of contributed to this body of knowledge, but there was like, no, wait a minute, volume restoration is key, you know, and volume restoration is something we need to focus on. And around that time, facial fillers started to come about. And so that then became like the most, it really revolutionized again, all of cosmetic facial surgery. And the other thing is it was much safer, cheaper, and with significantly less downtime compared to surgical intervention. So then it became like the pendulum swung the other way. And again, you know, what I said about Botox, you know, the companies can have non-surgeons now injecting these. It's a much bigger market. And so, you know, there's been a whole array of facial injectables over the last 20 years now, almost, right? Like early 2000s, as they became popular, and we're into 2023. And so I can go into like the different types of fillers and sort of all that stuff in a moment. But now what you're seeing, like, you know, Madonna's like an example where, you know, patients are getting so much volume restoration that, you know, they've swung the other way. And so, you know, there's different terms for this, but it's like the pillow face or the filler face syndrome. And essentially now it breaks that cardinal rule that I mentioned earlier. You never want to draw attention to treated areas because it looks so unnatural. It takes away from, you know, like it actually is a strong negative, but we see it all the time. And so I could stop there if you had any questions about that.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Does Botox typically go with fillers? Like, is there one thing that Botox is doing where if somebody says, I'm going to get Botox, you say, okay, it's a natural conversation to say, do you want fillers? Or not so much, because Botox isn't really taking away, I mean, it's taking away wrinkles, I guess, the muscles, but it's not inducing that kind of atrophy and loss of volume. Or would you say, no, they actually do go hand in hand in terms of their functions?
Yeah, no, Zale, they're actually very, very different. And so a lot of our patients do come in with that question and they often confuse the two. If I said, oh, have you had fillers before? Oh yeah, I had it. And they think it's Botox filler. I think that it's in popular culture and in most people's minds, I think that those two things go hand in hand, but they really are very, very different. So the Botox will only treat dynamic lines. So let's say I said to you, just kind of make a Frankenstein face and pause, like frozen. You know, Botox will only do that. It's not going to take away your deep, like, you know, nasal labial folds or take away any deep wrinkles. Maybe over time, if you keep getting Botox, let's say for a couple of years, you'll see like some of the deep wrinkles that you have started to diminish. But what I tell them is just kind of have a frozen face and that's all Botox will be able to emulate. Like it'll take away dynamic lines and that's it. Of course, it can improve skin quality, et cetera, in the longer term, but fillers really are not for that purpose. They will not impact your dynamic movements unless you do them inappropriately. Really, what they're trying to do is fill volume deficits. So there's different types of fillers. So fillers that are to be injected in different parts of the face, some that will last a little less time, some that will last longer, some that are targeting more like skin rejuvenation or what we call mesotherapy. They're made in a different way than, let's say, higher G prime fillers, which are cross-linked biochemically to last longer. They're thicker and they're more for deep injections. But really, when you're thinking of fillers, you're actually, as the name says, you're filling a volume deficit. So, you know, what can you fill? Like popular areas are the lips. Fillers for the lips are going to be different. Fillers for cheeks, fillers for under eyes, fillers for chin projection, jawline projection, fillers to the temples, you know, so it goes on and on. But essentially fillers are very, very different than Botox. And so a patient who comes in worried about, let's say, creases for the lower face, you know, we call those marionette lines. You know, like it's a popular area or deep nasal labial folds, you wouldn't inject Botox in that area, for example, you would inject filler. But let's say a patient comes in and says, oh, I hate my 11 o'clocks around the upper kind of between the eyebrows. that you would inject Botox for.
Because that's a more dynamic area, like you said, correct. Where you're actually actively moving your face, and Botox yes. is better going to target that, whereas fillers are going to maybe address some of those other areas where it's not so much an active movement that is bringing out that look that is undesired.
Yes. Yeah.
Exactly. What is, a lot of people are wondering, and I guess without getting too much into the nuance, because there's so many different types of fillers, I imagine, what is in these, and are they dangerous? And I imagine a lot of people are fearful of fillers in terms of, well, what exactly are you putting in my face? How long does it stay there? And what are some of the long-term repercussions, if any, of that?
For sure. So Zail, I'll go over sort of the different types of the broad categories of filler material, but I'll be honest that more than what you inject is the person injecting, like the technique used and where it's injected is much more significant, because the main, adverse reaction, I guess, is, drawing attention to the treated area and it being overcorrected. I think that sort of is the biggest problem, and poor patient selection. But in general, the two big categories are hyaluronic acid-based fillers and kind of non-hyaluronic acid-based fillers. The hyaluronic acid-based fillers are the ones that are the most prevalent. They're injected the most often. The reason for that is hyaluronic acid is part of our regular skin. It makes up part of the skin called the extracellular matrix, and it's something that when you inject it can also be dissolved with hyaluronidase. So it makes it safer. It makes it much easier for, let's say, I'll use the word like a non-master injector to kind of start with. And again, if the patient doesn't like the results, it can be dissolved with hyaluronidase. So it's basically a sugar molecule. And what happens is that after you inject it, the sugar molecule or polysaccharide will then attract, it's the medical term is hydrophilic, but it'll bind up to 1,000 times its weight in water. So once it's injected, it will increase in volume. Now, this is where sometimes some novice injectors can get in trouble, because as the patient sitting in your chair, you're like, oh, I'm going to keep injecting and filling until I see the desired result. But then if that patient ends up having more affinity to water, they may end up looking a little bit more puffy than you had anticipated. So over time, people tend to learn sort of with their injection technique, how much to inject over time. Now, different types of fillers within the hyaluronic acid category can be differentiated by a term called G prime. And there's a whole bunch of nuances in terms of, cohesivity and so forth. And there's a lot of different injection techniques that people will use with needles or cannulas, and whether you lay it in stripes or you make like little conical deep injections, or you use multiple different types of filler with different G primes for different areas. So as you get more and more comfortable, the master injectors can really do a lot with fillers. Now, being an eyelid guy, I'm not a big fan of fillers around the eyelid area specifically. And the reason for that is, even if you had, let's say, artificial intelligence and a perfect computer making perfect calculations, analyzing all of your anatomy and injecting, let's say, around the eyes very predictably, the problem is in a very dynamic area, like we're, blinking, closing our eyes, making facial movements all the time, that filler will migrate. So filler migration, I think, is one of the biggest risks, where even if you have a great injector, you can't always predict it. And so that's something that I think is one of the issues. And there's certain areas where it's more of an issue. So the temples, let's say, are not going to be moving as much as, or let's say people who get it in the nose, even to reshape their nose projection, won't be much of an issue as like near the eyelids, especially the lower eyelids and areas around the mouth as well.
In terms of fillers, how long do they typically last for? And is there such thing, this will sound so naive, is there such thing as removal of fillers, or they just naturally kind of go away over time?
Yes. And so with fillers, again, depending on the type that you inject, so there's some that are going to last only about 6 months. And those tend to be the more superficial, let's say you're injecting to the skin surface. So the tear trough fillers, certain lip fillers, on average, may only last for about 6 months. And sometimes, they can last up to a year. For the hyaluronic acid fillers that last longer than a year, like up to 18 months, those tend to be the very high G prime fillers that are injected deep into the cheek area. But on average, you wouldn't see anything more than 2 years, if that. because again, it'll migrate. And then for some people, based on their metabolism, they may metabolize it a little bit more quickly. Again, with hyaluronidase, you can certainly inject it to dissolve filler if it's overcorrected or it's migrated to an area that is not desirable. But the problem is that although fillers, technically, if you kind of look it up, they say that they're, you know, temporary. If you look at certain animal studies, they do find that they're kind of like permanent implants where you can still see that material hasn't completely left the body. So unfortunately, in my practice, I see patients even 7 years, 8 years after they had, let's say, a hyaluronic acid filler. I won't name any specific companies, but then, you know, they're still having swelling associated with that. And around the eyelids, especially, you can get this discoloration if it migrates superficially, which we call the Tyndall effect, but it's basically like a bluish discoloration that looks very unnatural. Patients hate it. And even after you dissolve it with hyaluronidase, it still leaves behind, you know, this long-term swelling and problems. And so there are significant risks with facial fillers that I think people need to be aware of. If you ask me personally, like I'm very, very conservative in terms of how much to use and when to inject, but that's just me. I know in our practice, you know, other practices, dermatologists are very good at it. They inject a lot more than I do and they enjoy it, but it certainly is something that I would say is very different than Botox, carries a lot of different risks and does have less predictability in the long term.
What I'm gathering, and it's so, you've done such a great job explaining each of them, Botox and fillers and the distinguishing features. What I'm gathering is that for people who are, and this isn't meant to sound judgmental, but for people who are looking at some of the Hollywood stars who presumably are going to very, very qualified surgeons, and you look at some of them and say, wow, what did they do to their face, so to speak? They look totally different or unrecognizable. And some Hollywood stars have even come out and said, I'm not happy. I went too far. It sounds like most of that probably results a little bit more from the fillers than the Botox, not to mention other procedures, which we're not talking about. But is that accurate, that the predictability, as you say, of fillers is a lot lower than that of Botox?
Yeah, Zale, you know, it's hard. I think you're hitting some really accurate points, but they're so nuanced where I know, like, we probably need to have a 2-3 episode podcast for this. But the thing is with the Hollywood stars, let's say Madonna is a good example, right? So one issue is that if you're trying to get a surgical result with fillers, just by pumping in a lot of volume, it's not going to look natural. So I think that's one problem where, okay, the tissues are lax, but, you know, fillers are being overdone. It's almost like if you have a cake, you want to use a little icing at the top. You don't want half the cake to be icing. So, you know what I mean? Like where I use them as like, it's just like the accent, you know, like a refinement tool, but it's not meant to be like, okay, let me take away all these wrinkles with filler. I think that's one big problem. The other issue is people who have deep set eyes. So if you think of a person with deep set eyes and high cheekbones, a lot of the classic beauties in Hollywood, like say Nicole Kidman, Madonna, like those are features of a beautiful person, typically, you know, like very good bony projection and kind of a little bit more deep set eyes. And so when you start adding a lot of volume around those eyes, they start that takes away from the beauty of the iris. You know, like you and I are ophthalmologists. The beauty of the iris is what makes the eye beautiful and often how we identify with a lot of these celebrities. So again, I'll just stick with Madonna. But if you look at a lot of these celebrities, when they've got a ton of cheek filler and all of a sudden you can't even see their eyes because the cheeks are projected so far forward, that's where, you know, you're like, whoa, like that looks really bad. But had it been a patient with more, I'm getting into like very specifics, like bigger eyes and not so much cheek projection, that you wouldn't notice it. It would actually look okay, the same amount of filler. So that's one aspect of it. And just again, having spent some time in California and being involved in some of these discussions, sometimes it's driven by the actors or celebrities in question as well. Like they're trying to get roles, they want to be seen and noticed. And, you know, and it's like, if you think back to even Michael Jackson's doctor, you know, he kind of pushed things too far and they're trying to make their celebrity clients happy. So it's a really tough thing. But as physicians, you always have to remember, do what's right for the patient. Don't get, like, I'm by nature, like someone who likes to, you know, kind of do what the patient wants and really be there for them. But I know my limits, like, okay, no, this is going to hurt the patient. I'm just not going to be part of it. And you may lose them as a client, as a patient, but in your heart, you kind of know, okay, I didn't take it into that category where they just do not look right. So I know that that's been something that, you know, some docs have struggled with their kind of higher profile clients.
For sure. I want to pivot a little bit in this end section to more of a philosophical discussion, and it can sound judgmental, but it's not meant to. It's just something that is natural that I'm sure you've been asked a lot, and that a lot of people debate when they're contemplating whether they want to get cosmetic plastics type procedures, whether it's Botox, fillers, or surgeries. I guess, is there a concern that you have, or that we as a society should have, that there is this desire and now ability to make people look younger to such an extent in terms of stigmatizing those who are just getting older naturally? And cost aside, but that's a huge factor, because obviously there's the fact that some people can afford this and many people cannot, but just the notion that older people are already stigmatized to such an extent, and as this becomes more natural and so many people are getting these procedures, some people are feeling pressured to get them so they don't look older, and already aging is something that people are trepidatious about. How do you deal with that on a philosophical level, and plastic surgeons in general? Is that something that concerns them?
Yes, I love this, Zale. This question is, it's a great question. So let's kind of look at it in a few different ways. So one thing to think about is that cosmetic surgery, facial cosmetic surgery, or body cosmetic surgery is part of the luxury service industry, for sure, right? So that's one aspect. We can just touch on that briefly. So, you know, flying first class will give you certain benefits that not everyone can afford. You pay for them, et cetera. You know, expensive watches, clothes, that whole sort of, so it is certainly that type of, it's part of the luxury service industry. The clients typically have different expectations. And so, you know, like they expect a certain amount of treatment and follow-up care and all that stuff, which, you know, especially being in like a social medicine system in Canada, right? Like it's stark difference for sure. So that's kind of one thing in and of itself, which we can kind of touch, we can come back to that point. The second thing is sort of the part of patient selection, where are you harming the patient psychologically by, let's say, focusing on their deficits and making them feel bad about themselves? And then, you know, they're kind of paying for this big surgery. So it can go down a very negative route. And you've seen patients, I think all of us are know, or maybe through friends and family, someone who just has gone overboard. Now that second aspect, I think, is something that I think about a lot. So one thing I do to frame patients is, you certainly, for me, I'll just speak to myself, is that you want to identify someone who has a compulsive personality. So if you think of compulsion, it's someone can become compulsive, and compulsion as a habit or as a personality trait is bad in any shape or form. So in plastic surgery, it's very dangerous for sure. And so I do not operate on patients where I feel that they're compulsive, you know. So I'll just step back for a second. You can be compulsive about alcohol consumption or food intake, or even being work compulsed, where it damages other relationships with your friends and family, et cetera. So in general, I think compulsion within plastic surgery, where someone, let's say, I see that they've seen, you know, three or four other doctors over the years, had multiple procedures, and now want me to do another revision. I tend to focus only my revisions on functional issues, and I try to avoid those patients, and I do my best to counsel. I'll spend an extra hour and just try to help them feel. Actually, just this past Friday, I had a guy who, you know, in Zoom was noticing one eyelid was a little off than the other, and, you know, and came in, and he had maybe half a millimeter difference, but it was causing a lot of anxiety. And he's a young guy in his 20s. And he said, "Can you just do a little surgery?" And I've done all my research and had all these diagrams and so forth. But we spent an hour where I talked him out of surgery. And I said, "Listen, like, you know, the two sides of the face are never perfect. You're still aging." And I felt really good about that interaction. You know, so you certainly do not want to operate on people where they don't need it. It's just bad, bad, bad. And so I think most of my colleagues would fit into that category. Now, sometimes it's not so stark. It's not so obvious. You have patients where there's a little bit of extra skin, let's say, and there's a few things you could do. But again, you feel that it's not the right candidate. And again, the psychology behind it, I'm still learning. There's so many things. You can look at motivators. So we ask about internal validation versus external validation. So again, if a patient says, for example, you know, I just, you know, separated from my partner and I just want to look good again and I want to get out there. Not that that's a bad thing, but then I'd probe deeper and I'd book a second appointment before booking surgery to get a little bit more. I'd get my coordinator to kind of listen in. And so really, you know, what I find most, you know, really good plastic surgeons or cosmetic practitioners will do is they know who to say no to. That actually gives, it's just a win-win. And, you know, some of the patients I have operated on where it, like, I just didn't read the signs, and it ends up not being a fruitful interaction, where even if you do your best surgically, I'd say their emotional home is not going to be happy and they're not content. You know what I mean? So it can go down a path. So I think, I don't know if that answers your question.
It does. I mean, when you say the word compulsion, I also think of addiction, and you can certainly see people who become addicted to this. And I think it's great that you do tap into the motivations of some of these people or of everybody who's coming in, because it's important to see why, because the common adage when people kind of, not that it needs defense, but people defend these procedures is, listen, if it's going to make somebody have higher self-esteem and that's going to make them feel better, then that's important. You need to feel good in your skin, and you need to have confidence. And if augmenting the way you look is going to help with that, then many people say, then that's a good thing. Then, as you've alluded to, there's the other side of the spectrum where, are you dependent on this? Is this getting out of hand where your identity is completely intertwined with how you look and you are addicted to looking perfectly? And there is a balance there, and there's no way in a conversation like this we could figure out what that balance is. Also, because it really depends on the person. But yeah, it's interesting. And I like how you acknowledged at the very beginning there that it is kind of a, I don't know what the word, it's kind of like comparing it to first class to an extent, and kind of just acknowledging that that's just the reality of the world we live in. And that is an umbrella that shapes the conversation to an extent.
Yes. Yeah.
The last thing I want to ask you about is really just about men in plastic surgery, because I feel like there's a misconception that it's really just women who go in for plastic surgery, but I know that's not true. In your practice, do you find a lot of men come in, and what are some of the more common things that men are asking for to be addressed? What are some of the trends that you're seeing amongst men?
Absolutely, Zale. Yeah, so in general, I think you'll find like all the data shows that there's more and more men worried about their looks or investing in their looks, whether it's like, you know, luxury skincare products. And, you know, you see it in the drugstores and stuff. There's more and more men's sections for these types of things. And cosmetic surgery is the same. In my practice, because I'm primarily an eyelid, an upper face, facial plastic surgeon, I get a lot of men who are worried about their under eye bags, looking tired. And there's a broad range. I'd say there's some who are doing it for work. Let's say, you know, they feel that they want to look their best, and especially, let's say, in the corporate world, they want to have that quote unquote edge. You know, with men, it's like those dominance hierarchies. I want to look the best. I want to be the best, that type of thing. So I get some of these sort of incentives to really kind of, you know, be not look tired. That's one big one. I do get functional issues. So if you think of men's anatomy versus female anatomy, so men generally have more deep set eyes, right? So if you think of like Clint Eastwood, he has deep set eyes versus Angelina Jolie, who has bigger eyes. So from a functional point of view, as men get older, brow descent and eyelid ptosis can be functionally more relevant. So sometimes it's just like, hey, like I can't see well, and you know, it's affecting my golf game, or when I read, I can't. So I'm getting patients who have, for men, I'd say a lot where there's like something functional that kind of brought them in, and they're like, hey, while I'm here, why don't I just, you know, I wouldn't mind looking a little younger, kind of thing. And they'll those combo types of procedures where they'll get their under eye bags done at the same time. I don't find men are really coming in for like lip filler or injectables in my practice as much, although I think that that is starting to be a higher trend, like especially in younger males, you know, preventative Botox and so forth.
And for preventative Botox, how young are patients coming in now?
Well, you know, you'd be surprised. We've had even teenagers contact our office, but in our practice, like we wouldn't do it younger than early 20s. I think 23 is sort of like where I think, you know, it's reasonable, but it's tricky though, you know, Zale, like you kind of, again, it comes back to your patient selection. Like if I find it's just, you know, someone who's already suffering with insecurity and depression and a significant mood disorder, you know, you have to be careful where you don't want them feeling like this is now, like you, I think you kind of touched on this, Zale, and I'm a little sensitive to it, you know, where the aesthetics industry could take advantage of people like that. They're in a little bit of a vulnerable state. They're looking for some direction and for a solution. And, you know, they go on their Instagram and they see, you know, whoever the Kardashians or the Jenners, I'm not up to speed on all of it, but they're like, they're getting this or that. And they're like, hey, wait a minute, let me find a clinic locally and I'm going to come and get some of these treatments. And it's like, no, wait a minute. So, you know, I think that'll vary from doctor to doctor and so forth, but I really try to dissuade them. I'll try to get them onto a skincare routine or something, just if I feel like it's a bit too early for their development. You know what I mean? Like they're not, it's not an adult mind I'm dealing with yet, where they're not fully aware of what they're doing. It's sort of like, it's like a gestalt feeling that you have.
And once you start on that process with somebody who's early 20s or teens as they're still developing, I mean, it's tough to get off anything once you start it, right? So that's a really important point. And again, I commend you because I'm sure not everybody says no to patients and they just say, sure, I'll take your money. Harmeet, do you have any final thoughts that you want to leave people with on this topic?
I'm really like honored and touched that you kind of had me on, and it's been a great discussion. I think as a takeaway message, I would just say that anyone who's kind of contemplating any of these treatments and stuff, you just got to do a lot of research. And if you ever do decide to move forward, and sometimes people worried about the risks and what to trust and stuff, I'd always say if you're going to go see a doctor and you're deciding on any Botox filler surgery, anything like that, just ask them what actual complications their patients actually had. It's a sort of a pro tip. So Zale, if you go in and you're going to get filler in your lips or something, you just say, hey, so how many patients have you done this for with the same technique and the same product? And how many of your patients have you had complications with, and sort of how did you manage those? And I'm not saying that doctor has to have zero complications, but you want to make sure that they were reasonable and that they had a action plan to manage those. I think that's just something to be aware of whenever you're kind of seeking treatments like this.
Well, great. And Harmeet, where can people learn more about you and iFace Institute? Granted, a lot of our listeners are not in Toronto and they're in the States and Canada and in Europe, but where can people learn more about you?
Yeah, sure. So, you know, our practice, again, as you said, Zale, is iFace Institute. So our website's www.iFaceInstitute.com, and you can get more information there if you'd like to reach out. I'm on Instagram at Dr. Gil MD, although mine's a lot of personal stuff on there lately, but I'm going to start bringing in some more professional information soon that might be helpful. So you can find me there.
Sounds great. Well, Dr. Harmeet Gill, thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure, Zale. Take care.
And thank you, everybody, for listening to another episode of Preconceived. Have a great day.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
So Robert, tell the people, what's a pretendian?
It's just what it sounds like, Angel. A pretend Indian.
Someone who fakes being one of us?
Someone who impersonates a native.
We're talking about real scammers and con artists.
There are pretendians teaching at universities, pretendians running governments, pretendians in Hollywood.
On our new podcast, Pretendians, we'll tell you the incredible story of these jaw-dropping frauds.
Who are they? Why do they do it? And how the heck do they keep getting away with it?
Listen to Pretendians on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.